In October 2019, the first ever International Conference on Environmental Peacebuilding was convened by the Environmental Peacebuilding Association at the University of California at Irvine. More than 250 people from 40 countries attended, practitioners, researchers, journalists, donors, policymakers, students, and activists. You're listening to Friday Podcasts from the Wilson Center's Environmental Change and Security Program. Over the next few weeks, we'll be featuring interviews with experts, practitioners, and leaders on environmental peacebuilding captured by ECSP on the edges of the conference. I'm Lauren Reese, and in today's episode, we'll hear from Wim Zwijnenberg, a humanitarian disarmament project leader for PAX, a Dutch peace organization.
Thank you, Wim, for being with us today. You've written quite a bit for New Security Beat already, so it's really nice to sit down and have a conversation with you. You're the humanitarian disarmament project leader for the Dutch organization PAX. And so we just wanted to start off and see, how did you get to where you are? What's your story? How did you get started in the field?
Yeah, well, thanks very much for having me here. And it's really a pleasure also having be able to contribute to the New Security Beat blog. And it's very influential and a very renowned website. So it's always a pleasure to write something. Coming back to your question on how did I get into this? So it was kind of interesting when I started working at PAX as an intern, and we had to explore the issue around the use of depleted uranium, which is a toxic heavy metal. It's basically low-level radioactive waste, which was used in munitions by the US in the Gulf War in 1991 and 2003. And our program in Iraq got questions from partners. There were concerns among people over the health effects. And so my boss asked me, can you just dive into this issue? And it's kind of interesting because my father used to be in the Air Force. And as a kid, I read all these books about weapons. So I recalled the issue around DU. So I was like, oh, that's interesting to explore what it actually is. And it turned out it's a really complex issue. Because if you look this up online, you see people saying depleted uranium has been the cause of all cancers and birth defects in the Middle East, and it's a big problem caused by the war. While at the other side, you see the US Army saying there's no problem at all, nothing to worry about, it's all hype. So what's the truth? So that's where we started this journey to find out, sort of unravel that discussion on what the impacts are. And the problem there was hardly any information. The United States government refused to release any information where they used it. They released a general amount, which was 400,000 kilograms, but no locations, like sort of general area. So that's where the first challenge came on, how do we find information on what happened in the conflict? And we worked together already we started working with the Center for Constitutional Rights in New York to do FOIA requests on getting information, but that takes time. So I started diving into open source back then. This was 2010, 2011, by basically reading memoirs from soldiers, newspapers articles, where it has been used, what concerns were. And then bits and pieces of information sort of helped trying to, you know, make this sort of jigsaw puzzle. And it was only through a freedom of information request with the Dutch government, because they were also based in Iraq, where we got the first target coordinates of where it was fired, which then set into motion a larger process. Eventually, 3 years ago, we got through the National Security Archives in George Washington University in DC, we managed to get the full data set of where it has been used. But going back to on the complexity of conflict and environment, is I went to Iraq and started interviewing people and doctors and going to communities, and being there sort of helped understanding, like, it was not just the depleted uranium which was an issue, it's the wider problem. And the use for it has turned out to be, at least in my opinion, it's a marginal issue. I mean, it still can affect people, but on very small local places, not as big as some people say it was, but it's still serious. But you also see the complexity of war and environment, and that's together with our partner organizations, we start to think around, okay, we should expand this. But then the next problem was, how do you do that, because it's war? How do you get information, what's happening on the ground in conflict? And that's where the sort of the journey and challenge began. And and I think the significant increase of information collection, data collection became more prominent in 2014, 2015 when we started working on Syria. And slowly and we started to collect information on doing a desktop study on what's happening, just all, again, through open sources. But I think, yeah, that's where also commercial activities and social media became very important. So there were activists and groups monitoring the conflict using social media. And that's where we start to think, what if we collect all this information, trying to see where fighting takes place, what kind of infrastructure is being hit, what do we know about this infrastructure from like normal circumstances, what kind of risk scenarios can you make? And that sort of helped sort of developing a better overview through open source information, through remote sensing, and through existing data databases on these kind of topics or places to build a sort of comprehensive view of what's happened in conflict and how it impacts the environment, but also, of course, how it affects people depending on the environment. So that's sort of the long answer to your question.
Yeah, and that's really helpful, especially for young professionals or students in the field, seeing your unique path forward in actually weeding out these complex interlinkages of the topics. And so going off of the data, the open source, those visualizations, here at the conference, your panel was on innovative technologies and environmental peace building. And so for those who aren't able to be at the conference or attend your session, could you give us more information on that work and successes and challenges you see?
Yeah, I think that's like building on the previous the question. I think it's the ability to visualize information is we're trying to do not only collect information but also use the information for advocacy to change policies, to engage with governments, with organizations. We want to see change from governments on, for example, what kind of stuff do they put in munitions, what kind of target selections do they do in conflicts, but also with international organizations on or humanitarian organizations, how do you respond to specific environmental risks that are born from conflict, or how do you take this information into post-conflict assessments. And these organizations didn't have the data or the time or capacity to do this kind of assessment or to do the monitoring. So we started taking all these remote sensing platforms. Like there's a lot of commercial satellite imagery or satellite imagery from NASA or from the European Space Agency. There were commercial companies who were automating the processing of the information, making it readily available online. And we start thinking, okay, why don't we check it daily, we track it, find out where the sensitive sites are, we're trying to see information from social media, where if fighting is taking place there, if something is being hit or not. There's like high resolution imagery we had access to. And so that's we could set up like a sort of monitoring model of environmental damaging conflicts. And then occasionally we publish reports on specific incident, be it oil refineries in Syria or crop fires in Iraq or pollution from spills in South Sudan. Mm-hmm. It's bringing together, like taking existing models and applying it to new situations. Sorry. And that's I think that's the innovative part of using existing means and methods for in new ways and expanding that, but also engaging experts who are helping to sort of improving that kind of work, mm-hmm. improving the results from our work, and then translating that to advocacy. So that's why we engage in platforms like the UN Environment Assembly, the UN General Assembly, or on state level to see if we can influence states on to push for specific resolutions, or to engage with militaries on their practices, or to work with health communities on including those environmental dimensions in understanding health risks born from environmental damage. Eventually we want to show you can do way more you can improve the conflict analysis and monitoring with existing means, where previously this was only left to organizations like UN Environment, who could only do stuff mm-hmm. when there was funding available, often after a conflict, and often also very limited because of restrictions they had or other conditions that were set upon their work. Like, not to criticize UN Environment, because we work a lot with them, but they were actually helpful and understanding and pushing us to improve our work, because it's showing or demonstrating there's much more improvement you can have with data sets. So that's why people like David Jensen and others are pushing this also to apply it mm-hmm. to other environmental issues around climate crisis or you name it.
For this big tech and this data that you're working on, where can you give a specific example of where you've seen this translate into policy action?
So the best example we have is in Iraq. So we started monitoring since 2014 what happened in when the so-called Islamic State took over large parts of the northern Iraq, and then the offensive became to push them back. And then they applied environment as a weapon by setting fire to oil wells, by setting fire to sulfur stocks. So to create a lot of the oil wells, for example, in Iraq were burning for 8 months. The burning sulfur resulted in sulfur dioxide, large plume of sulfur dioxide, which eventually resulted in the death of a dozen people. 1,000 people had to be hospitalized. And at the same time, also they damaged water infrastructure when they were retreating. The coalition bombed specific structures that also had impact on access to clean water or land use. So we started monitoring that since 2014. And eventually this information we collected helped pushing for a really strong resolution in UN Environment and UN Environmental Assembly. So we published our report there together with the Iraqi Ministry of Environment with their support, and showing that this is what's happening in Iraq in terms of the environmental impacts, and this is what needs to be done. And so that helped building support for the resolution. And moreover, when eventually the resolution was accepted, there was funding made available for UN Environment to do a post-conflict assessment. And UN Environment approached us asking, okay, do you have data for us on where the pollution is or where you have found environmental hotspots? So we were able to, we shared the data set with them. They went on the ground and do, with training Iraqi experts. So they went to all the sites we provided them, and they were able to find, 70% of the sites we gave them, they actually found pollution. So in that sense, our work helped pushing the advocacy for a strong UN resolution, and it helped eventually to speed up the process for the post-conflict environmental assessment, and hopefully save them time and money, and also demonstrating there's a lot you can already do during a conflict mm-hmm. to speed up that process.
And kind of on a different note, right now you're working on emerging military technologies and in their impact on how wars are being fought and consequences for arms proliferation. So I just wanted to know, how does that relate to environmental peace building, and what role does the environment play?
Yeah, it's a good question about how modern warfare is changing military tactics, but also what kind of new weapons or weapon systems are we developing. And one example we've seen in a month ago, for example, is the increased use of armed drones by state and non-state actors. And what's happening in, this is an example from Yemen, where the Houthis, which is an armed group who started a fight against the Yemeni, overthrew the Yemeni government in 2015, and which resulted in a civil war, developed drone systems with likely support of Iran that are capable of hitting targets over even 1,000 kilometers away. And of course, Saudi Arabia, who's fighting the Houthis, is bombing them on a daily basis. It's the biggest humanitarian crisis at the moment. But the Houthis are also trying to find a way to strike back. So they hit back Saudi Arabia, where it hurt the most, namely its oil economy. So over the last year, they have been targeting airports, water filtration stations, oil facilities, but so far, it had an impact on the Saudi air defenses. And in September 2019, I think around 25 drones and cruise missiles, and this time likely coming from Iran, hit the Saudi, the biggest oil processing plant in the world. It's also demonstrating how environmental infrastructure has become more sensitive towards being targeted, which means as a way of pressuring states. Mm-hmm. So states are finding different ways. There's no full-out war anymore. So it's specialized small operations. Mm-hmm. And we've seen that also with the attacks on oil tankers in the Persian Gulf. There have been incidents where oil pipelines were blown up in the coast of Syria. There's now recently a big oil spill from an Iranian oil tanker in the front of Saudi Arabia. Causes are well known, but their accusations have been going around that it's deliberately being blown up by other states. I think that's a concern where technologies are able to reach environmental sensitive targets, and it's being used as a sort of a threat or leverage by armed groups or state-backed groups or states themselves. So that's one example, I think, where drones are playing a significant role of being or giving the capability to states to do that. But we can also look ahead, and we can look at nanotechnology, for example, which is now also being developed, or the use of autonomous weapons. What kind of target selection? What is there an overview or oversight on AI systems? What can they target? What can they target? Can they already do an assessment of the environmental impacts if you target something? Mm-hmm. So that's going to be very, 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 very tricky. Direct energy weapons are being deployed, which, it's interesting from a humanitarian perspective to look at implications of new modern warfare and their related technologies and the environmental consequences of that. And I think of course states will try to frame this as everything is being done in an existing legal framework where we're trying to minimize that, but the legal framework is still vague, so it gives states a lot of space to interpret it and still attack certain targets which can have long-term environmental consequences. But it's sometimes a bit of a frightening future when it comes to that, because we have we have less environment, quote unquote. There's more people. There are more tensions over natural resources and access to that. And we're developing more and gruesome technologies to attack each other. And it's still, the future is still bleak when it comes to that. Bleak, uncertain, and beautiful.
So, and on a positive note, how can we flip it and see innovative technologies as a solution to these environmental issues?
Yeah, so I think I see a lot of potential in terms of, first of all, these kind of technologies or innovative applications of technologies provide us with more insights and on what's happening in conflicts. Therefore, we can respond faster. We can hold perpetrators more accountable because we know what's happening exactly. We can trace back who's responsible. It's empowering communities because people have the ability and the tools to understand what is happening around them, and that information is useful for policy work, for political pressure. So I see a lot of potential in, I think in particular, the accountability and the empowerment of people with these kind of innovative technologies, and understanding, visualizing the impacts of conflict can help raising more awareness on what the linkages are between environmental damage and conflict, but also responding to that. Mm-hmm. So if wars and armed conflicts are sadly won't go away, unfortunately, what we can do is respond faster to what the consequences of those conflicts are with these kind of tools, and also hopefully in the end also that could help being a tool of prevention, of demonstrating hey, this is what's happening in conflict, and this is a good reason not to start one, because eventually, it won't serve anyone's interest if natural resources are being destroyed or people are being displaced. And I think that raising awareness of that, and by visualizing those kind of impacts, by tracing back the perpetrators of specific attacks or damages to the environment, and by empowering communities, we've provided, or we hope to provide, and we'll build on, like, strengthening just the humanitarian community and environmental community with innovative technology. So I think that's the hopeful message which I see, and it's why I want to work on this, because I believe if I can do it, you can do it.
You've been listening to Friday Podcast from the Environmental Change and Security Program. For more information, follow us on Twitter @NewSecurityBeat and visit newsecuritybeat.org.